From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
There's several times that Dan and I have looked at each other and said, we don't understand why they're letting us do this. Like, we're just literally waiting for someone to come shut us down.
Gilmore Girls creator Amy Sherman-Palladino just picked up a Golden Globe for her newest series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. What's especially marvelous to Sherman-Palladino is that Amazon has given her and her husband Dan the budget to shoot a period show in New York and to license original recordings from such icons as Barbara Streisand and Peggy Lee. Sherman-Palladino and her husband, writer-producer Daniel Palladino, tell us about lovingly creating 1950s Manhattan, picking the music, and hiring dancers when they need extras. But first, an all-award season banter in an unpredictable year. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by a special buddy in banter, Scott Feinberg of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Kim.
So you are here because we are in the full swing of awards season. The nominations are going to be announced shortly. And by now, we usually have a sense. It's either this or this. It's either La La Land or maybe Moonlight, which seemed like a long shot, but actually wasn't. You know, sometimes you know the one that has the mark of destiny. Sometimes there's one or two. But right now, it feels like there's no mark of destiny. There's no one or two.
That's right. I think that there are scenarios at this point in time where we could see Get Out, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, The Shape of Water, Dunkirk, Lady Bird, maybe even Call Me By Your Name, breaking away from the field and winning. But as of now, the indicators that we look to have been all over the place. And the Golden Globes, for instance, went with Three Billboards as the best drama and Lady Bird as its best musical or comedy. The Critics' Choice Awards went with Shape of Water for its sole Best Picture Award. So there are just so many indicators that are pointing in different directions. And, you know, none of them may ultimately be relevant because the Academy is a very different group than any of these.
Yeah. So you mentioned some of the things you think will most likely be nominated. Others that could sort of slip in there would be The Florida Project, The Big Sick, I, Tonya, you know, Darkest Hour.
The Post and Phantom Thread and Mudbound and even Wonder Woman. There are constituencies for these. And the way the nomination voting works, it's really about passion. It's not necessarily just which movie shows up on the most ballots. It's which movie shows up high on a lot of ballots.
Looking at Best Actor, the nominations were made before the LA Times ran a piece critical of James Franco and the Me Too of it all. Do you imagine that he will squeak in and get nominated and then possibly people won't vote for him? Because my experience is when there's controversy or uncertainty or negativeness of any kind, the Academy seems to back away and just say, we're not going to make a decision. We're just going to walk away from this.
The rumors about what Franco had coming started towards the end of voting, and I think even the LA Times story came out just before voting ended, but many voters fill in their ballots, turn them in beforehand, and so at that point, there's no revisiting them. I think Franco is very likely to get nominated and then to lose, as was always going to be the case for him. This obviously might have further hurt his chances of getting nominated for a pretty bizarre movie that he also directed.
The Disaster Artist had come out a little earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Disaster Artist. But that category is very thin this year, and it's hard to imagine that he will not make the cut again based on the timing. I think we know that Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour and Timothée Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name are going to be in there. Chalamet is going to be the youngest nominee in that category in 79 years.
Wow.
Then you've got probably a slot for Daniel Day-Lewis, who normally can cough and get nominated.
Right.
And even though he's in a divisive movie, Phantom Thread, I think he'll make it. And then really, it's more to me a question of that fifth slot where you've got Tom Hanks for The Post. You've got Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out, which is a movie a lot of people like. And then even potentially Denzel Washington or Jake Gyllenhaal or some others who are in movies that people didn't go nuts about, but they are who they are. So that's a tough category for the fifth slot.
Let me jump over to Best Director. I know this isn't supposed to be political. It's supposed to be pure merit. But I'm wondering, I know you had been leaning that Guillermo del Toro, who's a very popular guy and has The Shape of Water, which a lot of people like, would end up being the consensus choice. But I can't help but wonder if Greta Gerwig doesn't get a little bit of an edge just because of the momentum of the Time's Up movement.
That's an interesting scenario there because she's not a guaranteed nominee because only the directors pick the directing nominees. and that's a heavily older male branch, and potentially they didn't click with that movie, which is more popular with women. But if she gets nominated and then the final goes to the full Academy for the second round, I think that helps her. But I think the bigger question will be whether or not she and Jordan Peele, who are both first-time solo feature directors, if they make it in there. They've got to hold off people like Steven Spielberg for The Post and Luca Guadagnino for Call Me By Your Name. These are guys who are much better known to their peers. You're correct that I think Guillermo del Toro right now is the safest bet to be nominated and actually to win. And interestingly, that would be the fourth time in the last 5 years that a Mexican filmmaker has won in that category. Nolan, for Dunkirk, looked like he had this early on, but he has really sort of faded from the conversation, and he is a stark contrast to Del Toro in that Del Toro is the most gregarious guy and Nolan is not. So I think that category ultimately probably ends up being very similar to what the Directors Guild did, which was Del Toro, Nolan, Peele, Gerwig, and probably Martin McDonagh for Three Billboards. Although, again, that last slot, I could see something weird happening where maybe Sean Baker for The Florida Project gets in, or Guadagnino or Spielberg.
Yes, so can't write
that's
them
a
off.
Interesting mm-hmm. category.
An actress just feels like it more or less belongs to Frances McDormand, but Saoirse Ronan is in there, and that's potentially compelling. You have the de rigueur Meryl Streep on the list, Sally Hawkins, and Margot Robbie, but it feels like this is Frances McDormand's year, I guess, again.
Possibly, and you're right, she won 21 years ago for Fargo, although it will be an interesting test of how much the glad-handing aspect of things matter, because there have been people who just don't do it, and they have still managed to win, like Christian Bale for The Fighter, like Monique for Precious, and Frances McDormand just will not participate in the process at all, aside from showing up to the actual award ceremonies where she's nominated. So part of me wonders if they'll give it to somebody new who hasn't won before, and I do think that the nominees will include Saoirse Ronan for Lady Bird, who this is going to be her third nomination. She's only, I think, 23 or something, so it's amazing that she's already going to have three under her belt. Margot Robbie has the advantage of also having produced her movie, and she will be the first person to be nominated for Best Actress who also produced the movie that she's nominated for. I'm not totally sure that Meryl's going to actually make the cut, which is a crazy thing to say based on the fact that historically she gets in for
anything,
for almost anything, because, yeah. You know, granted, she's always very good. But I think there may be a sort of fatigue of that. And this movie is not as loved as people expected it to be. So a slot will be there, I think, for Sally Hawkins for The Shape of Water, which is a very popular movie. And then the question is, will Meryl end up holding off somebody like Jessica Chastain for Molly's Game, or even Diane Kruger for In the Fade, which is a German language movie, but there are a lot more international members of the Academy now, and I think that there's a shot.
We'll see what happens. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
That's Scott Feinberg, awards columnist at The Hollywood Reporter. The Amazon series The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel opens with the perfectly coiffed, newly married Mrs. Miriam Maisel, played by Rachel Brosnahan, standing at a microphone, exuberant and in love.
Who gives a toast at her own wedding? I mean, who does that? Who stands in the middle of a ballroom after three glasses of champagne on a completely empty stomach? And I mean completely empty, because fitting into this dress required no solid food for three straight weeks. Who does that? I do.
Mrs. Maisel is thus launched into what she thinks is her dream life. She's the perfect 1950s wife and mother, with a beautiful Upper West Side apartment and a stunning wardrobe. She loyally stands by her husband Joel, who works a desk job during the day as he tries to launch a comedy career at night. But Miriam Maisel's world suddenly falls apart when Joel announces that he's leaving her for his secretary. A stunned and drunk Mrs. Maisel hops the subway downtown in her nightgown and finds herself on stage at the club where her husband had tried to make a name for himself. As she shares her tale of woe, Mrs. Maisel does not realize that she's about to alter the course of her life.
I dressed in costumes. I gave him kids, a boy and a girl. And yes, our little girl is looking more and more like Winston Churchill every day, you know, with a big Yalta head. But that's not a reason to leave, right?
The creator of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is Amy Sherman Palladino, who also created The Gilmore Girls for the WB in 2000, as well as the recent reunion miniseries for Netflix. Her husband, Daniel Palladino, is her writing and producing partner. So far, they say Amazon has been very good to them in terms of creative freedom and budget. Of course, Amazon, under the leadership of the now ousted Roy Price, had been accused of favoring shows created by men and for dropping one of its few female-fronted shows, Good Girls Revolt, despite strong reviews. Price was also accused of sexual misconduct. Sherman Palladino says she and her husband managed to set up shop at Amazon just in time to miss much of the controversy.
The interesting thing, you know, we came into Amazon when the turmoil was sort of already sort of starting. So we actually weirdly are kind of on the outside of it because the people that we've dealt with at Amazon are still there. As far as I know, they haven't done anything weird. And they've been very supportive and really great to us. So we're like everyone else, just sort of viewing it from the outside. I think a lot of our show also is, you know, our show, we shoot in New York, which is a whole different ballgame than shooting in LA.
I want to talk about that a little bit.
So I think that they sort of took the whole picture into account.
It's a tremendous vote of confidence.
It's a very big vote of confidence. And, you know, the pilot turned out very well for them, and they entrusted us with a large bag of gold, and we spent it wisely.
Well, I have to say, when I was watching the thing, I thought, is this as expensive as it looks? I mean, it looks amazing. You're doing locations in New York. I heard you shut down Washington Square.
We are the scourge of New York. We are like...
We have been cursed at in so many languages.
Oh my God.
Downtown is the worst. When you go uptown, they're a little more friendly, a little more open to it. But for some reason, you go into the Village, which we love. Oh, people don't like us.
But yes, we've shut down major streets to redo the garment district. And we've done
dressed for period.
Yeah. There are several times that Dan and I have looked at each other and said, we don't understand why they're letting us do this. Like we're just literally waiting for someone to come shut us down.
Right. But it's really amazing. It's obviously working.
Yeah.
The music. I had been told that you actually are filming with the music playing, which adds to not only licensing. I mean, when I first heard Barbara Streisand, I was like, is that a Barbara Streisand sound alike? And then I'm like, nope, that's Barbara Streisand.
Barbara Streisand.
Happy days are here again.
That is, God, that's expensive, right? That's like, it's so important to you, I know, but
it's
obviously
so important, and we're willing to, you know, you have to allocate your funds as you need, but the music is so much a part of building this world and bringing people into, you know, Midge's journey from uptown, downtown. So as she's discovering it, we want the audience to discover it, and you must have the music for that. It evokes the feel and the
story.
How
do you figure it out, what you want?
It's years and years of Gilmore Girls. We always placed our music on Gilmore, and music is a big thing. He has a problem. There's a Sonos issue where he's possibly will bring down every computer in the world off of the amount of music library he has.
I have millions of pieces of vinyl and CD.
It's not
I forced her to become a music fanatic.
Oh, yes.
Sometimes, like in the case of like Old Peking and the pilot, Amy had written that into the pilot. We played it while Rachel was walking around the Village and doing her shopping in character on that day.
Come to the supermarket in Old Peking. If you want.
Sometimes we're in the editing booth and we need a piece of music, and we'll just go through our iPods and just rack our brains and just try to think of.
But then you're already editing, so you wouldn't have used
sometimes
it.
Sometimes it's afterwards.
Sometimes it's after. Mm-hmm. A lot of time. But if it's a key piece, a story piece, like in the pilot, Old Peking, Wonderful Day Like Today, the Peggy Lee, Pass Me By.
Pass me by.
Those were all written into the script. They were in, and part of it also for the pilot was to show the Amazon what the music flavor was going to be, because that's a whole other argument that you have to have with networks. For example, this music on a network never would have happened.
I was going to say,
and not just because of the money, but networks are run by the marketing department. They're not run by the creative department, and that is a problem because marketing, they'll be affiliated with Warner's music or Sony's music, and that's all you can.
Right. I mean, Amazon's marketing department is very excellent. I just want to put that out there. But you know, we've worked for Netflix, we've worked for Amazon, and as a business model, they are trusting creators more than other places.
Because at this moment, we don't really know who's going to be running the place.
That's true.
Jeff Bezos runs the place apparently, and the world, and he'll be ruling
I feel like
Mars.
I should just mention that I may or may not have had something to do with the fact that we don't know who's going to be running it. I'll just disclose that.
Oh, young lady. We're up on the skinny.
You're up on the skinny. Well, I feel obligated just in the interest of full disclosure. Okay. It's not an accident that you have no... But whoever comes in is obviously going to say, hi, I like the one that got all the love. So
right.
I'm not saying anybody should be worried. So when you have a song, like you say, I want that song, that Peggy Lee song. Is it because you know it in your head and you're hearing it in your head when you're writing?
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you do it together? You literally sit together and write?
No. That's why we're so married.
That's how we keep our marriage together.
There's no way.
Our process basically, quickly, is we break stories together. So we hash out all the scenes, all the details.
And
we do that together.
For the season
and we do that with a group of writers, or we do it with just me and Amy, and we come in and do that. And then when it comes down to just actually writing the dialogue, we go off to our separate corners and
do the
writing.
I mean, are you Joel and you're...
No,
Midge
no.
Or nothing.
I'll write episode one, he'll write episode two. I'll write episode three, he'll write episode four.
Okay, then comes the sticky part where you have to say, I don't like what you did in scene three or whatever.
But you know what? We've been doing this with each other for so long that, first of all, we hash out so much in the story breaking process. We know the attitude of each scene. And you know, once you know the attitude of each scene, the sort of the beginning, the middle, the end of the scene, where your character is going into that scene, where they are coming out of that scene, there's very rarely a time where we're like, oh boy, I don't like the spin you gave on that scene, because we've already discussed it. Sometimes I will get a note on how many expletives I've put in, for example,
from Dan, who will
say you have over-mammoted your scripts and it's time to de-mammot it a little bit. But right now, we are so in tune because we've been doing this together for so long.
You don't have to tiptoe around each other?
No, not at all. And in fact, the whole point of us working together is to not tiptoe around, because the thing that I feel I never, and I think I'll speak for you too, we never want to fall into is we never want to become people that nobody will say to us, this isn't right, this doesn't work, that's not sharp enough, I think this can be better. You need somebody to really challenge you who does not have an agenda, whose agenda is not to score points with anybody else, or it's just purely for the good of the work. And that's why our partnership is so good, because it doesn't matter who wins or loses. Is the work right or wrong?
Right. Yep. That sounds good. If that's it works. Do you feel obligated to sort of stay? I mean, she does curse quite a bit, Mrs. Maisel. Just quite a bit.
She's got a little potty
she
mouth.
She jumps right in there
a
when she's
potty
in this
mouth.
Club. A little potty mouth. I mean, do you do the research and say, would a woman in the 50s do this?
Oh, our poor researcher. We have this delightful researcher who has like 12 master's degrees in everything in the world. And all she gets is like, did they say her back in 1950? I mean, literally, it's like this poor woman. It's very interesting what they, because you had a couple of those that I was like, that just feels too modern.
Yeah. And I think No Way Jose was one of them.
Yeah.
That goes back. And like It's a Gas was actually.
It goes back? No Way Jose.
No Way Jose.
Back. And she says It's a Gas at one point, and I thought maybe that's 60s, but that's way back, because it's actually jazz, 40s, 50s. So it's interesting. We're learning as we go along, because it's, you know.
We don't want to get caught out with that stuff. I mean, the thing is, everyone around us is so good. Our production designer, our costumes, our props, our special effects woman is a magic genius. I call her Tinkerbell, because she just waves a wand and stuff happens that I just don't believe it could possibly happen. And everybody's working at such a high level that the last thing we want to do, when everyone's making sure that the piping on the wall and the colors are correct, that we're the ones that come in and just throw a bunch of dialogue in that it is not appropriate. So we try to be up on it.
Yes, it's a good day.
Coming up after a short break, Mrs. Maisel bosses Amy Sherman Palladino and Daniel Palladino tell us why dancers make the best extras. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today we're talking to Amy Sherman Palladino and Daniel Palladino, partners in life and work. Their show, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, now streaming on Amazon, just won a Golden Globe for Best TV Comedy, and star Rachel Brosnahan also took home a Globe for Best Actress. Brosnahan plays Midge Maisel, a 1950s Manhattan housewife who reinvents herself as a stand-up comic after her husband walks out on her. She gets some encouragement along the way from groundbreaking comedian Lenny Bruce, played here by Luke Kirby.
Do you love it?
Do I love what?
Comedy. Stand-up. Do you love it?
Well, I've been doing it a while. Okay, let's put it like this. If there was anything else in the entire world that I could possibly do to earn a living, I would. Anything. I'm talking dry cleaners to the Klan, crippled kid portrait painter, slaughterhouse attendant. If someone said to me, Leonard, you can either eat a guy's head or do 2 weeks at the Copa, I'd say pass the f***ing salt.
Was there a reason why you said, I'm going to make this a real person in my thing?
Partially because he sort of represented the shift from in comedy at that time, where the comedy was going from a little bit more sort of structured set pieces to talking about what's really going on in the world, questioning authority, free speech, religion.
Right.
And he was sort of the shepherd of that.
Yeah, he's a bit of connective tissue.
Yeah, and he got killed partially by his own stance, you know,
right.
and a lot of drugs.
But you didn't want to do Lenny Bruce like, you made it Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, when Lenny Bruce does, I think we have him do two separate comedy routines. They are
I
verbatim.
Heard those are licensed verbatim.
They are well, verbatim. We would not put words into Lenny Bruce's mouth.
Never. Are you kidding me?
Not on stage.
Write a comedy bit for Lenny Bruce.
So he's like a pole of reality to hold on to create the world. Is
yeah,
that basically
yeah,
what you're saying?
And a good muse for her. There's a Joan Rivers story about she did a set one night and she bombed. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible set. And Lenny Bruce was there and he sent a note backstage that said, you're right, they're wrong.
Oh,
and
that was nice.
Yeah, and there was something about that it's always stuck with me. And I felt like for Midge to have that.
She needs that guy.
Yeah, in her life. And a guy that's not looking at her as a piece of ass yet.
I was waiting to see if
he
would.
Know.
Because
he's very handsome.
Yeah.
it's just purely on a level of you are interesting and your thought process is interesting and your force of nature is interesting. I just like that juxtaposition of him and her and the look of Lenny Bruce with the woman with the clothes and the gloves and the little purse. It just felt like a good pairing. And then we put him in the pilot. And Lou Kirby is an extraordinary actor. He's not just a pretty face. And because of that, it's like you kind of wanted to see them converse and you wanted to bring them back together every now and then. It almost took a life of its own once we cast Luke.
Now, you were a dancer in your earlier life.
In my thinner life, I was a dancer, yes.
Well, in that you get to have actual food. It's probably a change for the best in some ways. But
it's nice to have a sandwich.
I heard you have dancers as extras.
A lot of the times, because when it comes to movement and big crowd scenes, you need people that feel a rhythm to be able to physically move with the camera, get out of the way in certain ways.
And move confidently,
And move
too,
confidently and not feel tentative or not be looking. Dancers are extraordinary creatures. Their work ethic is unbelievable and their bodies are just a tool and they know themselves so well and they know their environments. Everybody always gets nervous when we do like any sort of big dance number. And Dan and I are like, no, the dance number is going to take 5 seconds. It's going to be the other shit that takes a lot of time because the dancer's going to get this in 1-2 takes and you're done. So anytime we do anything where we have any sort of big camera walk-in kind of thing, anything that we put to music, even if it's not an actual dance number, always cast dancers.
Yeah, when Midge first walks into B. Altman department store, I think in our episode 5.
Yes, that's 5, very choreographed.
All of
looking.
Those girls are dancers.
Yeah. And boys.
Yeah,
and boys.
And the boys. And we're not shy of having a little bit of magic in a thing like that because part of that is supposed to be it's how Midge is experiencing it. So when she walks in that B. Altman, that is kind of a magical place and she's picturing herself there. So people moving in a little more not as real movement is sort of a reflection of how Midge is seeing the store herself. So we don't shy away from stuff like that.
So while the New Yorkers may generally hate having you around, the dancers are very grateful.
Oh, yes, the dancers are always.
I think you're great.
Yeah. Dancers are amazing creatures.
And you have some stand-ups, right, working as consulting?
We have two stand-ups, Jen Kirkman and Noah Garden-Schwartz.
When you write the dialogue for her sets, do you sort of go off with one of those people or play it back? It's like, how does this sound
to
you?
It's the hardest thing we do, and it's the hardest acting. I mean, there's a lot of difficult acting things that Rachel has to do, but she has to come off real. When the extras are laughing, the people at home watching this can't be thinking, why are they laughing? Because I'm not laughing. It's a really,
really
high.
There's nothing worse than that.
It's a high bar for all of us. Generally, with Rachel's stand-up, we write it. So if I'm writing the script, I write Rachel's stand-up. Amy wrote her stand-up in hers. We get some help from the whole group. We have a couple of stand-ups. We have a couple of other writers. So sometimes it becomes a little bit of a group effort. And then anytime there's an outside comic, and we've had outside comics doing their thing, we get a lot of help from our comics and our group because that's a high bar too. You know, Lenny Bruce is easy because we license his stuff, but we, when we see other comics performing,
he had already written that part. Yes. Yeah. Yeah,
and we licensed some Red Skelton stuff too when Red Skelton was
on
stage.
If we ever put a real comic in, we're going to license their stuff. You know, Rachel's stand up is actually easier for us to write because it comes out of story. You know,
she's telling about her life.
It's rants. It's what happened. You saw three scenes ago.
But you didn't cast a comedian in the lead. Right? Rachel does not have a comic background. So that was an interesting choice.
She's never really done comedy.
Yeah.
She's always been tied up and thrown in the back of a van or buried alive or drowned or
good times.
Lovely little girl. They're always beating up on her or something. We needed an actress for this. You know, there's a lot that goes into this role. And it's not that there aren't stand-ups who can act. There are. And we auditioned a lot of people. We auditioned stand-ups and actresses alike, but we knew we were probably going to end up with an actress who was going to have to turn into a stand-up. Part of the reason that we chose that stream of conscious kind of style for her stand-up is for that very reason, because we thought an actress is going to be able to latch on to the reality of what she's talking about. So if we give her that roadmap, as long as Rachel knows why she's going into this act, she's going to be golden.
So in this weird, unstructured world of Amazon and streaming, second season is almost like a construct, right? If they give you two at the same time, it's really a very long season, right? It's like
a little bit, yeah. We were midway into the first, we'd already sort of started when they did this giant double pickup, which was delightful. But we still stop and you do your post and then you have to deliver that first season. So
do you sort of deliver the package of all?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's very different from broadcast, right?
Yes.
Is it better or worse to have to do it all like a book instead of a series of essays?
22 episodes is very hard. Gilmore was a very, very hard show. It was a hard grind on the actors. It was a hard grind on us. So in a sense, this is a little bit more, you have more time to craft everything and make sure that everything is good. You don't have to let an episode get away from you because literally the time has run out and you have to sort of let it go. Like you can fix things and make them beautiful. And that is a wonderful luxury to have. And it feels like for a show like this, like it demands that sort of attention and time to do it.
Do they say, I mean, is it a real deadline? Like,
oh no, they have to, because we went into it the same way as thinking, well, it's Amazon. They don't, you know, when you're done, you're done. And they have very specific benchmarks. And also because we're New York, stage space is like gold bullion. You know, if you've got a stage, you hold on to it because they're at such a premium. If we left our stage for a month, it'd be gone. We'd never get it back again. So
a sneaky Pete would sneak in there and take it.
So he's been lurking.
He's very sneaky.
He's so sneaky. So we have to also keep our production going and locked in a good thing so that we don't lose our people, so that our crew don't drift away to other jobs. It takes a village.
It's
to
us.
Make a Maisel.
Amy Sherman-Palladino is the creator and Daniel Palladino is the executive producer of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Gorna and Christopher Ho. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.